welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, January 5th, 2021. The Anglican Church in South Sudan is mediating in intercommunal conflicts.
The problem of Trekeka is that all these resolutions have not been implemented. Cattle have been stolen. The resolution was that it has to be returned. It has not been returned. As such, people take laws by their hand.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Religious leaders and civil society activists in Central Equatoria State say they are working to address intercommunal clashes sparked by cattle raiding and political differences. Paul Yugusuk, Archbishop of the Central Equatoria State Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, says the Anglican Church is working with various communities to reconcile groups and stop intercommunal violence in Terekeka and Lanya counties. For VOA News, Daniel Friday-Martin reports from Yei.
Religious and civil society leaders say although Central Equatoria State is witnessing relative peace and stability, intracommunal violence triggered by cattle raiding and revenge attacks, especially in Terekeka and Lanya counties, has led to loss of life and property. Paul Yugusuk, Archbishop of the Central Equatoria Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, tells South Sudan in Focus, a lack of strong laws on the movement of cattle and justice for victims of cattle raids has increased the level of violence among local communities.
The problem of Trekeka is that all these resolutions have not been implemented. Cattle have been stolen. The resolution was that it has to be returned. It has not been returned. As such, people take laws by their hand. But we are going to understand and come up with a new strategy on how to implement the resolution, whether they are old or new. Of recent, there is a movement of cattle from outskirts of Juba to Lanya, even up to Yei. And this is extending the conflict to other neighboring counties.
Bishop Paul Modi of the Terekeka Diocese of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan says more than 50 people were killed and hundreds of others displaced by sectional violence in December alone. Modi says religious and community leaders are organizing meetings between communities to try and end intercommunal violence once and for all in Terekeka County.
The people killed more than 50 just in December alone. Many people have been affected. Many people have been living in hiding. Properties were lost. And in several consultative meetings that we held, all of them are ready to reconcile. In 2021, let us give room for peace and dialogue so that we can move forward.
Edmond Yakani, Executive Director for Local NGO Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, says the government should consider disarmament mechanisms that respects fundamental human rights if it wants to reduce intercommunal violence.
The disarmament didn't work effectively and responsively because there are critical factors that the state need to respond to. And among those critical factors are provision of safety and protection for the lives of the communities through police that can adhere to the principle of human rights and rule of law. And the state also need to engage into a serious intercommunal violence mitigation that is free from political manipulation from the political elites. In this beginning of 2021, it is essential to dedicate attention and resources for mitigating these ongoing intercommunial violence.
Yakani says his organization and other NGOs are organizing a national dialogue towards the end of this month to address issues related to ongoing cattle raids and revenge attacks across the country. Archbishop Yugusuk is appealing to armed and non-armed actors to reconcile their political differences and work for lasting peace in South Sudan.
Reconciliation has been affected by the ongoing conflict. You know, there is ongoing conflict, killings, and that really affects because we can't do our work when people are fighting. Now that there is an ongoing dialogue in Rome, the last one gives us hope. I know it's going slowly, but we are hopeful. We also call upon the conflicting community sections in other parts of South Sudan, the opposition as well, the government, that time has come for us to put our heads together and join the revitalized peace agreement and so that the implementation become easy.
In his 2021 New Year's message, President Salva Kiir called on all South Sudanese to reconcile and work for peace, adding the transitional government is committed to peacefully resolving conflicts across the country. For VOA News, I am Daniel Friday-Martin, in Yei.
The UN Refugee Agency reports some 800 Ethiopians have crossed into eastern Sudan in the last 5 days, bringing the total number of refugees who have fled there from conflict-ridden Tigray to more than 56,000 since early November. Newly arriving refugees speak of widespread looting, forced recruitment of men and boys, and sexual violence. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The number of daily arrivals is lower than at the start of the crisis, when fighting in Tigray was particularly intense and thousands were fleeing every day. Nevertheless, the UN Refugee Agency sees no let-up to the violence, abuse, and dangers confronted by civilians. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahedjic says hundreds of Ethiopians continue to flee for their lives. He says refugees are arriving in eastern Sudan fatigued and weak after days of travel, with little more than the clothes on their back.
Latest arrivals tell of being caught in the conflict and being victims of various armed groups, facing perilous situations, including looting of their houses, forced recruitment of men and boys, sexual violence against women and girls.
Mahedjic says more than 30% of the refugees are younger than 18 and 5% are older than 60. He says two reception centers located near the border with Ethiopia are overcrowded and pose a security risk to the refugees. Consequently, he says the UNHCR, partners, and Sudan's Commission for Refugees are relocating the refugees as quickly as possible to a new site deeper inside Sudan. He says the government and humanitarian agencies are scaling up their assistance to the growing refugee population. More than 20 agencies on the ground, he says, are providing shelter, health, food, and nutrition services. He notes the needs are great and more funding is needed to carry out this humanitarian operation.
In particular, it is critical to further improve water and sanitation conditions in the refugee camps and reception areas, as well as ramp up COVID-19 preventive measures, including isolation facilities. Additional funding is also required to sustain shelter projects and improve the living conditions of refugees in the camps, especially in anticipation of the next rainy season, which is expected to start in May.
At the end of 2020, the UNHCR and partners appealed for $156 million to meet the emergency needs of Ethiopian refugees fleeing Tigray through the first half of 2021. So far, only $40 million has been pledged, far short of what is required. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As New Year begins and a new American presidential administration prepares to take office, relations between the U.S. and Africa have ever been more complex or potentially more promising. For a broad look at where things stand and what to expect with respect to American foreign policy towards the continent in terms of aid, security, and other matters, VOA's Adam Philip spoke with John Campbell, a fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Campbell, who was U.S. ambassador to Nigeria between 2004 and 2007, began by stressing the continuity of relations between the United States and Africa over the past two decades, despite Trump's public pronouncements of substantial change.
The often fierce rhetoric from the president about making significant cuts in various programs that benefit Africa. Virtually none of them happen, largely because of bipartisan congressional opposition.
Which programs do you have in mind?
For example, Power Africa, an initiative of the Obama administration designed to increase the production of electricity in Africa, that has continued. The Young African Leadership Initiative, also an Obama program designed to groom young people for leadership positions in Africa, that has continued. And PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, a Bush initiative, has continued. And then President Trump's signature initiative with respect to Africa was designed to make American investment in Africa easier. That is just being rolled out now.
The truth is that for many Americans, Africa seems incredibly far off. In simple terms, can you explain why Americans should care about American policy toward Africa at all?
Well, let's start with demography. There are a great many Africans, and there are going to be a great many more of them in the relatively near future. Let's take a specific example. Nigeria at present has 205 million people. By mid-century, 30 years from now, it is anticipated that the population will exceed that of the United States and that it will be, in fact, the third largest country in the world by population. That should provide new markets and opportunities for investment and for general increase in economic links. Then let's move on to security. Particularly in the Sahel and in West Africa, jihadi groups are active, seeking to overthrow governments that are friendly to us. They're deeply hostile to the United States, and while they do not at present pose a threat to American security, they certainly pose a threat to American interests. And they may pose a threat to American security in the future.
And then there is the general movement toward democracy in Africa,
which Americans, almost all Americans, support and favor. Some African countries very much have a democratic trajectory that is positive. You put all that together, and we should be paying a great deal more attention to Africa than we have in the past, not as a matter of charity or assistance or aid, but simply because of our own interests.
What about American diplomacy toward Africa in the incoming Biden administration?
I find it interesting that President-elect Biden's choice for American ambassador to the UN, probably our most important diplomatic position, that he has tapped Linda Thomas Greenfield, a career diplomat who specialized in Africa and was ambassador to Liberia.
Of course, aid is a big part of America's policy toward the continent.
But I would caution here. The American economy is challenged. The incoming administration does not have as much money as I suspect many Africans assume it will have. I think in the shorter term, where the difference will be quite clear is in rhetoric and in atmosphere. There will certainly be an end to disparaging comments about Africa that have come out of the White House. I would expect that President Biden will visit Africa and that he will host African heads of state. These are matters of symbols, but symbols are extremely important.
That's John Campbell, a fellow for African Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Uganda opposition leader says he will contest any irregularities in the coming elections. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the mode of travel you most often use to get to work?
Thank God I have a car for over 9 years, so I drive my car to go to my workplace. But sometimes if it has a problem, I use tricycle.
I usually use the minibuses, but more oftenly I just walk from where I live because within the area that I work.
I have an old bicycle. I ride on it anytime I'm going to work.
I use the public transport to work most of the time because it's easily accessible and it takes me to where I'm going.
I ride in my husband's car to work. He has his own car. So every morning he picks me and drops me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. And in our Tuesday health segment, we look at one African country that is struggling with the new variant of COVID-19. Nigeria is grappling with more cases of the new variant of COVID-19 virus amid second wave of the pandemic. Health officials say infections spiked after people ignored an advisory against intra and intercity travels. Dr. Anthony Ibe is Assistant Professor of Medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. He says the country should expect more deaths and hospitalization in the coming weeks.
For Nigeria, with our poor health system, overcrowding, and lack of social safety net by government or other local governments and so forth, it frightens anybody who looks at it. For example, if you read the recent report by the Lagos State Health Commissioner, Professor Bayomi, was talking about 5 hotspots in Lagos. And they're having some areas positivity rate as high as 31.3%. That is extremely high. So Nigeria, therefore, is at risk of an overwhelming spread of the disease and affecting and killing so many people.
The health authorities are blaming the citizens for not heeding a travel advisory when it was issued, and that is responsible for this widespread and also the variant.
There could be blames to go around for everybody. The citizens cannot be blamed for the variant. We haven't found out the reason why the variant has occurred. Even in the United Kingdom, you saw there was a variant. In South Africa, they have another one. So variants of this virus will occur, pop up in various parts of the world. That will be a given. In terms of adherence to preventative measures, the citizens may be blamed to some extent, but you also want to look at it against the background of what is happening. If you're poor, your whole livelihood is dependent on trading, there is no government subsidy or some kind of remedial check or something, what are you going to do? Is it the problem? So that's where the government needs to come. You can't ask people to stay home if they don't have food to eat. They will say they'd rather die. So that's where the government must come in and say, we will be able, if we're going to do a lockdown or have people to stay in, we'll be able to make sure everybody gets one bag of rice, one bag of garri, or any of this basic sustenance for the next 2 weeks also. And then everybody, minimum wage of, if you're maybe 2,000, 3,000 naira, I don't know what exact number it would be for each family, then people can take you seriously. People can now listen to what you're saying. Because one, it'll be for a short period of time, and two, it will help to, you know, cut down on the spread. And more so, we have not perhaps done a good job in the messaging.
Critics of the government are saying that the government failed to adequately message the population, especially in a country where you have close to about 100 different languages.
I agree with you that messaging is important. It's very, very important, especially when there are all kinds of conspiracy theory. You even know in the United States, some people say it doesn't exist, it's a manufactured disease, and you go online, there are all kinds of weird theories. You can therefore imagine what the situation is in Nigeria. A number of people say it's a white man's disease, it's a Western disease, it doesn't happen here, the heat kills the virus. Wrong. So that's where you're correct, that the messaging is important. The government needs to go down to the local level, different languages, local level, even in broken English that everybody would like to understand. Involve the market leaders, involve the towns and the local community leaders, involve the traditional leader, involve the youths. In fact, one of the slogans should be COVID-19 or Corona is everybody's disease.
Nigerians are known for their communal living, and a lot of people are saying that's also part of the problem. So how do you navigate this?
One, let us all believe and know that this will be a short-term thing. This is not going to be our life going forward. This will be a short period. So if we say, please do not visit your relative in the next 2 weeks, in the next 1 month, let them stay in their own households.
That's Dr. Anthony Ibe, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine. He spoke with Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Still on COVID, the South African government plans to provide COVID-19 vaccinations to at least two-thirds of its population of 60 million people by the end of the year. The country is part of the World Health Organization's vaccine procurement mechanism, COVAX, but that will only be able to provide 6 million shots to South Africans in 2021. The government will have to source the rest through deals with vaccine manufacturers themselves, but no such agreement are in place yet. For VOA News, Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
The government announced South Africa's vaccine rollout strategy after pressure from citizens, civil society organizations, and health professionals. They'd been asking why the state wasn't sharing the plan with the African nation most affected by the pandemic. COVID-19 has led to the deaths of almost 30,000 people and infected more than 1 million in South Africa. Critics say the vaccine rollout should have started by now because the government should have pre-ordered vaccines from manufacturers. But Health Minister Zweli Mkhize says he couldn't take a chance on pre-ordering and paying for a vaccine that turned out to be ineffective.
Maybe today the argument would be about how government was so negligent to waste money on unproven vaccines. The risk was high.
He says the government hopes to get vaccines from COVAX by April. But Mkhize knows South Africa can't wait this long. A second wave of COVID-19 is causing infections and deaths to spike. So the state's trying to buy vaccines as soon as possible directly from manufacturers.
In fact, we are targeting February, although all of that is going to depend very much on the success of the current bilateral negotiations that we are having with various companies. So it is really more our wish, and we will not at this point say there's any company that's confirmed that date. We're just fighting to make sure we can get something earlier than that date by the COVAX facility.
The minister's negotiators are speaking to Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, and Cipla. Deputy Director General for Health, Anban Pillay, says the government also has asked Moderna for vaccines, but the company has confirmed it's not interested in deals with South Africa. The head of the country's Vaccines Advisory Committee, Professor Barry Shoup, says science has shown that countries need to vaccinate at least 67% of their populations to achieve herd immunity.
And the figure of 67% is a rough calculation of the threshold based on the reproductive number of the virus. In addition, of course, we do need to lower the possibility of this infectious agent circulating the community. So those individuals who do get vaccinated, we aim to have them also not act to transmit the infection on an ongoing basis.
Pillay says health workers will be vaccinated in the first phase of the rollout.
Phase 2 looks at essential workers. These include our police officers, miners, workers in the security industry, retail, food, funeral, teachers, persons in the congregate settings, those that are in care homes, detention centers, etc., anybody who is over 60 years of age, and then finally those persons that are older than 18 years with comorbidities such as diabetes, chronic lung disease, which has been associated with...
Following this, says Mkhize, 22 million people will be vaccinated as soon as possible. Pillay says mobile teams of healthcare workers will give the jabs at workplaces, public and private clinics and hospitals, and at specially established vaccination centers. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, says he will protest any illegalities in connection with the country's January 14 presidential election. Joel Isanye, spokesperson for Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform Party, says Ugandan security has repeatedly harassed Wine and his campaign, while Ugandan police have said they are reinforcing COVID-19 regulations.
We have concerns about the election process. Right from the time of consultations, our candidate was denied chance to go out and consult because the election starts there pretty much, because an election is not an event, it's a process. and then the way the campaigns have been held, that our candidate cannot be allowed to go to certain areas, to go to certain districts. He's been denied access to media houses and all these different places. And now, you know, a lot more that we hear that is being cooked by Mr. Museveni, his regime, in concert with a couple of people within the electoral body. So these are concerns that we have. These are concerns that we are raising, and we are telling them, look, we are very alert, you every step, and so Ugandans are not going to allow a process that is going to disenfranchise them. They're not going to allow their votes to be rigged. They're not going to allow their voices to be curtailed. That's the message that we are sending to Mr. Museveni and those around him.
Is the Honorable concerned that the elections could be rigged? I mean, what is the evidence?
Of course, he is concerned. The rest of us are very concerned. But we know that ultimately the power of the people transcends anything else. You know, and that's why we say people power. So that's why we are rallying the people. Come out, vote in droves, take your vote. They'll try to vote. I mean, they'll try to rig. They'll try to do many things. They'll try all the machinations. But ultimately, the power of the people will prevail. That's our hope. That's our hinging point.
I was reading an article in the Monitor on Monday. The article says that more than half of the people that were shot to death during last November's protest were between the ages of 14 and 30, and that nearly a dozen of the 54 victims confirmed by the government were in the productive 30 to 50-year-old bracket. What is the reaction to that?
It's very unfortunate that Mr. Museveni has decided to kill those who oppose him, to kill those who don't support him, those who support Bobi Wine, you know, as opposed to doing it rightly, because the young people that are protesting peacefully, the rest of us that are opposing him, because we want a better country. We want better health care. We want better education, you know. We want jobs for our young people, many of whom are unemployed. We want a better economy. We want the human rights violations to stop. Those are the things he should be addressing, as opposed to shooting dead people that are opposing him, people that are against his policies, and all of that, you know. So those are the critical issues that he should be addressing.
Of course, President Museveni said that these young people were being urged on by the opposition, being responsible for the way the young people behaved.
These are not just young people. These are Ugandans, you know, with a sound mind. They know what they want. We have to tell them that now come out and oppose Mr. Museveni. They're opposing him because they don't have jobs. They're opposing him because they're being brutalized. They're opposing him because when they go to hospital, there's no doctor to attend to them. They're opposing it because when they take their children to schools, public, there's no structures. Children are studying under trees. So no one needs to tell them to rise up and oppose Mr. Museveni. The circumstances really lead them to do this.
That's Joel Sanyi, spokesperson for Ugandan opposition presidential candidate National Unity Platform Party. He was speaking with my colleague James Batty from Kampala. That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Lo So. This one goes out to our listeners on RMC Radio 101.5 FM in Nimule. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you are in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I don't